Well, hey, everybody. Welcome to Episode 7 of the Ankeny Fanatic Weekly Podcast. As always, it is brought to you by our good friends at the Ankeny Office of Iowa Realty. They are located at 1802 Southeast Delaware, Suite Number 103. They are the proud sponsor of Ankeny Fanatic. They have 75 agents specializing in residential, commercial, farm, and land properties. Well, we have a very special podcast for you today. We actually took the podcast on the road. We're coming to you from the shoreline of Clear Lake, Iowa. Our guest has graciously invited us to come up here and spend a little time with him, and we really appreciate that. He is an Ankeny native who is best known as the Iowa State head football coach from 2009 to 2015. Of course, I'm talking about Paul Rhodes. Paul, thanks for having us. Really appreciate it. How you doing?
Welcome to Clear Lake. I'm doing very well. Good to have you all up here.
Oh, well, we really appreciate it. I like the view up here. It's pretty nice.
Yeah. As the saying goes, you had me at hello, and that's what it was when we walked through the front door and saw the view of the lake. And been a really nice place to have up here and very relaxing.
I'll bet. Well, I know you're just starting your vacation now. You're going to be in Iowa for a few weeks, but I understand you have to go back to L.A. a couple times to put in some office days, huh?
Yeah, we have two office days that everybody's got to put in. During our summer vacation, the NCAA changed rules here. I couldn't give you an exact number of years. It was when I was at Iowa State that you could start coaching the guys in the summertime. And so you get 2 hours a week that you can coach them. And every coach has got a couple of days where they get 2 hours with either side of the ball. Chip has it set up where one offensive or defensive coach will be in a week for the 5 weeks that we do have some time away and have our OTAs, if you will, which is what we're referred to them at, similar to what the NFL does. And so I'll fly back in the middle of it and spend a couple of days in L.A. and then get back here.
Well, of course, you're getting ready to begin your first season as the defensive backs coach at UCLA. You're talking about Chip Kelly, the head coach. Now, this is your ninth coaching stop overall, if I did my math right. And, of course, you started your coaching career out at Pacific, so how does it feel to be back on the West Coast?
Well, it's strange that there's still a number of people out there that I know as far as recruiting goes and relationships. Not many sitting head coaches are at the same place, but there are a couple. Some guys are ADs, and some guys have gone on to other things. But when I was at what we refer to as UOP from 92 to 94 with Chuck Shelton, a familiar name to many in the Midwest and in the Des Moines area, I recruited the San Fernando Valley, which is the northern area of L.A., which is where I'm living right now, and getting back in those schools and those neighborhoods, and it's been enjoyable. It's good to be back on the West Coast.
Well, I know that you didn't personally know Chip Kelly before you were hired, so what was the connection that brought the two of you together?
As often is the case in this profession, this guy who knows this guy and coached with this guy and so forth. So trying to keep a long story short, a guy who GA'd for me at Pitt when I was the coordinator there was Chip's secondary coach at San Francisco. And he didn't know Chip either before that time, but the coordinator got hired and brought him along. Well, this guy had been working Chip on my behalf, and that was my foot in the door. Our defensive coordinator, a guy by the name of Jerry Azzanero, is a guy who I replaced at Iowa State in 1995 when I came to work for Dan McCarney. Jerry never coached a game at Iowa State. He went through that first recruiting season, recruited guys by the name of Joe Parmentier and James Elmore. He was our East Coast recruiter that first recruiting season. Anyway, Jerry left. Jerry and I crossed over for about a week in Ames. So we'd met each other, knew of each other. There were a number of guys that I worked with at Pitt that worked with Chip and Jerry at different stops. So they were able to do their research enough to evidently feel good about me. And the interview was fun. I was there about 3 hours and got offered the job. So that's my type of interview.
Oh, that's great. Well, I'm sure you had an impression of Chip Kelly before you met him. What do you know about him now that you didn't know before?
I'd tell you he's very similar to what you see. where I would have told you Brett Bielema is probably a little bit different than what you see. His persona that you pick up in the media, you might think this guy is you know, arrogant or just he's a quotable guy, but Brett was just, he's just candid and high character and high integrity and so forth. What you might not know that if you just went by what you see in the media. Where Chip, I think the observation him is he's a no nonsense guy. He's very matter of fact, you know, systematic in everything that he does, and that's all accurate. Has a way of doing things, and that's the way it's going to be done, and it's proved successful for him at this level, and he, like we all are, anxious to get back at it and apply that system at UCLA.
Well, the Bruins are coming off a 6-7 season under former coach Jim Mora Jr., and of course they lost a top 10 NFL draft pick in quarterback Josh Rosen. After going through the spring drills with this team, how would you assess the talent in the program, maybe compared to what you saw at Arkansas the last 2 years?
Well, I'd probably say it's similar to what I saw at Arkansas the last 2 years. And you know, we were a 500, sub-500 football team at Arkansas. And as you just said, they were 6-7 last year. So I'd say it's very comparable. I'd say it's even more comparable in a couple spots. I think the O-line needs built at UCLA. I don't think our depth is exceptionally good there, and certainly not what you want it to be. A little bit different. We had an established quarterback at Arkansas last year for sure, and it was his first year starting in 16, but last year he was a veteran guy. We're unsettled at quarterback, and we have a transfer from Michigan, Wilton Spate, that's on our campus, and then we have a true freshman coming in from Bishop Gorman, a really great high school football program in Las Vegas, Nevada, and those two will be asked to challenge for the starting job right away. With three guys that battled for it this spring. So I think there's some holes. I think there's a lack of depth at a number of spots, and we have a great challenge of recruiting and as a staff of figuring out what is in the Pac-12, and that's where I'm probably the most blind, having never coached in this league and not playing many of those schools recently. So I don't know what we're up against, but we got some work to do.
Well, of course, Chip is known for his highly explosive spread offenses, and I can't imagine he's just going to come out this year and all of a sudden run like the wing T or something. Do you feel like that the talent that you guys have in place, you know, can run the kind of attack that he wants to run?
You never know. Chip's very diverse, so he could run the wing T.
Yeah. That'd be fun.
Might start the season with it. He's a brilliant offensive mind, and I think he adapts to what he has, and I think we already started doing that in the spring as we learned more about our personnel and what potentially our football team can be. He very much is reliant on pace, and that is not going to change. That's how we train. That's how we play. I think the offense and the philosophy is, I'll choose the word equalizer. I think we can probably be better than maybe potentially what we should be based on the offense. So we will be running this system and certainly running it as effective as we can with the personnel we have. We're certainly not without players. I mentioned earlier that the offensive line might be an area of need or weakness. I think it's also with our system, a place that you can not hide guys per se, but get away with certain things. Where at Arkansas, we were down in the O-line, and when you're running a power football, you know, run it two tight end offense, you can't hide those guys. Mm-hmm. But using the pace that we do, and also using the space that he does, I'm anxious to see, but I think we can be effective with what we have.
When you obviously coach the defensive backs, what's the talent look like there? Do you have much experience returning?
I'm very fortunate. I probably have more experience and develop players than potentially any other position on the roster right now. We have, coming out of spring, we have 9 scholarship players on the roster, and for the most part, all but a couple of them have played already and done a nice job. We had 2 players that decided to hold back from the draft this past season and come back for their senior year, and very appreciative of that and a chance to work with those guys. But we have 5 guys that we signed in this 18 class, and we'll give all those guys an opportunity to compete and play too. So I know I got 9 guys that I can put out there, and I wouldn't be spooked with any of them putting them on the field. So you're talking about at least a 2 deep, and we'll need a freshman or 2 to fill out a nickel spot or a corner spot because of how we train. You got to have bodies, without being asked, Dan, I'll tell you, that's one of the things that Chip and staff learned at the NFL level was there just weren't enough bodies with practice squad limitations and restrictions, you got to have, they believe, 80-some numbers offensively and defensively to prepare game week with scout type of players and so forth, and that just doesn't exist in the NFL.
Well, having that kind of depth in the defensive backfield, that's probably something you can use, because I know one of the drawbacks of that kind of offense is it puts some pressure on your defense if you have a quick 3 and out, so I'm sure that's something that you're already preparing for, isn't it?
Yeah, and we are, by design, about a 2/3 to 1/3 ratio in your starters and your backups playing. So there'd be a lot of programs across the country that are going to play 11 to 16 guys. Usually the D-line is going to rotate a little bit and roll in and out. But a lot of guys will play their entire back 7, linebackers and secondary, the whole game. And we're not built that way, and the offense doesn't allow us to be built that way. So we need 22 to 24 guys on defense to play for exactly the reason you said, and we'll do it. Whether we'll be able to talent wise match up when we do it, we'll find out.
Well, let's talk briefly about your schedule. You guys will open up the season against Cincinnati on September 1st. And then a week later, you're going to visit a place that you're very familiar with. You guys go to Oklahoma. Do you have very many memories of those trips to Norman?
Bad.
Yeah.
bad memories. So happy for the program last year when they were able to win in Norman and break a long-standing drought. In the 90s, we thought we had them one game let a should have been interception get away from us, and then had a penalty after, that was a tough one because we thought we had them down there. Such a storied program, and Lincoln Riley has just taken off where Bob handed him the reins and done a tremendous job, and they do a great job of recruiting and have done so for a long time. It'll be fun. It'll be fun to go back there and let these kids from UCLA see what that place is like.
Well, then, of course, later in the season, you guys will host USC, and I'm sure you know all about that rivalry, even though you haven't seen it up close yet. You've been involved with a lot of great rivalries, Auburn, Alabama, Iowa State, Pittsburgh, West Virginia. How do you think this one's going to compare or be different than those rivalries?
Yeah, Ohio State, Michigan, Pitt, Penn State. I feel very blessed to have been a part of so many great rivalries like that in a career. So I'm excited to add this one to it. Out on the West Coast, you quickly learn, because of geography on this one, the importance of it. You're head to head a lot more in recruiting than some of those other battles. I would even tell you, they're more head-to-head at USC, UCLA recruiting battles than there were at Iowa State, Iowa. 2 major programs in one state with so many places in our state. So you already feel that tension between the 2 schools and what's at stake, and we'll look forward to playing that game.
Well, you mentioned earlier where you guys are living out there now. Are you getting pretty well settled in out there? Do you know your way around LA now?
Surprisingly, yes. As big and vast as it is, it's happened pretty quickly. I've got a 15-minute drive to work every morning, which was something that I mandated for the realtor when we started looking for a place. I'm in my backyard as far as recruiting goes, so I spent the spring sleeping at home most of the time, which is really nice when it comes to normally being in a hotel during that time. As big as it is, there's a lot of familiarity, as I said, with recruiting there in the past and recruiting at Iowa State. So you get to a place and all of a sudden you remember being here with this coach or for that situation. We found ourselves to be at home quite quickly.
Well, that's good. I heard you did have an incident out there this spring. Didn't you have like a bike stolen or something?
Yeah, I did. I've been greeted by several things in Los Angeles that I haven't necessarily liked. Yeah, I rode the doggone thing down to McDonald's to get me a breakfast sandwich and even locked it up. I wouldn't normally do that, but I locked it up and came out and guy had cut the chain and he was taken off and I gave him a yell and gave him a chase. But I had a nice bike, so it rode pretty fast, so I wasn't able to catch him.
Oh, gosh, sorry to hear that. You guys aren't like living in Compton or something, right?
We're a little bit north of there.
All right. Well, have you had a chance to get your Harley out on the freeways yet?
Plenty. You know, I thought Arkansas had good riding, but California in quick time from our house, we can be in some great canyons and great views, and you can go from city riding to the PCH Pacific Coast Highway to some back canyons and mountains and woods that are just gorgeous in no time. We did so last weekend before we left. I've put quite a few miles on it since we've got out there. Plus, I ride it to work pretty much every day.
All right. Well, we're visiting with Paul Rhodes. You're listening to the Ankeny Fanatic Weekly Podcast, sponsored by the Ankeny Office of Iowa Realty. The Ankeny Office will close in excess of $250 million in real estate in 2018. Their agents represent over 20 new construction builders in communities all over the metro with interest rates at historic lows. Would you like to know more? What your home is worth in today's market? If so, you can give them a call at 453-5800. That number again is 453-5800. Well, let's get back to Paul. We mentioned Arkansas earlier. Let's talk a little bit about your time there under Coach Bielema. You guys went 7-6 and went to a bowl game in 2016, and then last year you were promoted to defensive coordinator. And then last year, like you mentioned, you guys struggled to a 4-8 record, and Coach was eventually fired. What do you think went wrong last year, or was it a combination of things?
Well, I think it was a combination of things. We were behind in personnel. There was some misses and some holes in recruiting, and in every Power Five program, you can't do that and be successful, and especially in the SEC. The SEC is a defensive line league. It still is. There's been some changes and a lot more spread offense being run in that league also, but it's still a defensive front league. And we lost five guys after the 15 season, and so we were down there a little bit. We transitioned to a different defensive scheme, which always takes a little bit of time getting used to. And as I mentioned, we were down a little bit in the offensive line, and all things that contributed to a 4-8 mark.
One of you guys had some close losses there at the end of the season. I actually made a trip down there with your brother Tony and your dad for the Mississippi State game. That was one of those tough losses that you guys had. And I remember you saying, later that weekend that, you told all of us, you said, we're going to be fired. Do you just kind of sense when those things are going to happen? You've obviously been around for a long time. You've seen a lot of things. I mean, is that just something you just kind of sense, or do you see some tangible things that let you know that that's coming?
Both. There's tangible things, and certainly there was unrest in the athletic department there, the athletic director was let go, and when he's the guy that hired the head football coach, the reasons why that maybe things were stacked against him also are stacked against your head football coach. Just the trend in winning and losing, and the expectations of a certain place like Arkansas in that league, so there are definitely tangible things and other things that you can sense them blowing in the wind.
Well, you were then named the interim coach, which was a position that you held for a week or two, I believe. Was that kind of an awkward position to be in because you're trying to hold down the fort, but then you're also trying to think about what you're going to do next?
Yeah, it was the first time in that position. And what was really awkward is how it took place. It took place immediately after our season-ending loss and Brett's firing, which took place as soon as he walked off the field. And I was asked to fill that interim role before Brett even addressed the team and the players. I looking back on it, I understand their thought process of just wanting to have something in place and be able to tell the media and so forth. But it was really a role of babysitter, if you will, and making sure our kids were doing right and staying out of trouble and finishing up academically and in a time of transition while they look for a new head football coach. And I didn't mind it because anything for the player's sake is a good responsibility to have. Didn't deter me from looking for anything, and the administration was good if that indeed did happen, that there was complete freedom to pursue.
Well, now I want to go back to your days at Iowa State a little bit. Obviously, when you look back at your career there, you guys had some tremendously high highs. You had some really low lows. When you look back at those, 7 years in Ames, what do you remember the most?
Well, I think being from the state and growing up right there in Central Iowa, the chance to be home is probably what I remember the most, and being around family. Being around friends, being around Iowans, the great people that they are, and the great fan base that the Iowa State Cyclones have, and in all that they do, being around that for 7 years and having a chance to bring them some celebration and some feel good times with some of those great wins that we had, and there were a number of milestones that we hit and things that the program hadn't experienced in its longevity. And then, as you said, there were low lows and lessons learned in the process. You always hope to leave a place a better coach and know you'll be able to be better at your next stop. And leaving there, there's no question if I ever get the opportunity to be a head coach that the lessons I learned in Ames and with that program will serve me well.
Well, I think you have a plaque on the wall here that even commemorates that great win over Oklahoma State. I'm sure you think back to that win occasionally, don't you?
Yeah, we finally, after moving to Fayetteville and not unpacking some boxes and making another move to Los Angeles and still having those boxes, we finally opened them up and sorted through some things and it was time to get rid of some things and get rid of a little weight and a couple of those things that are associated with the Oklahoma State game I promise you I didn't get rid of and other tremendous things that we accomplished while we were there I held on to. So there are great memories and that night in Ames beating Oklahoma State was certainly one of them, but so was an afternoon in Lincoln, Nebraska, and an afternoon in Fort Worth, Texas, and in Lubbock, Texas, and great road victories against ranked football teams.
Austin, Texas as well, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, you talked about the lessons that you learned. You've told me before that you not only want to be a head coach again, but that you feel like you need to be a head coach again. You obviously feel like you'll be better prepared, the next time around. So what were some of those lessons that you think you learned?
And if I was to rank it, I'd tell you right now I need to be as more so than I want to be. Because I'm having fun doing what I'm doing, just having a room again and coaching guys. But I say need because the way it finished and the bad taste that it left in my mouth, I need another opportunity to go back and write that a little bit in my internal feelings. I think there's so many factors that go into building a program. And certainly at the top of that list is who you bring in. And I think I've learned through the last two guys I've worked for already with Chip and with Brett, some maybe better methods of doing some character evals and so forth on some of the background checks on kids that you bring into your program. You can only learn so much in the short period of time that recruiting is, but you got to learn as much as you can. Chip has a line that he likes to use. You got one jackass on your team, no big deal. You got two of them, you got a jackass farm before long. And you know, we suffered that a little bit at Iowa State. We got a couple bad seeds in the locker room, and it affected us a little bit. And you got to work hard to stay away from that. And just finding the right men of character and bringing them along as you build the culture of the program is something that I look forward to doing again. Staff and staff loyalty and just having the right fit there is something that's a high priority in the process, and putting another staff together would be something that I'd like to go through that process again and the inner workings year round of it. It's not there's so much in the 8 months that's not the season that build a football program, and being a part of that, you know, are just a couple things that come to mind.
Well, if you had to rank all those things that you talked about, what do you think is the single hardest thing about being a head coach?
Demands on you, and because they come from every direction and every angle, and most of them you're not aware of until you become a head coach. The obvious things you prepare for, you know, putting your staff together, recruiting a class, the numbers that you have to juggle for scholarship, the style of offense you want, the style of defense, the philosophy you want to have in your weight room, how you want to set up your practice schedule. But all that stuff is easy, and you can see it coming. But when you get in that office and you sit down in that chair, what you're not aware of is how many people walk through that door on a daily basis and are just simply demanding of your time, whether it's scheduled or not. And I think you got to realize that's just the way it is and be in a position to deal with it. I've got so much respect for the guys that can run an offense or run a defense also as the head coach and their ability to maybe delegate some of those other responsibilities. I just think if your fingerprints are going to be on the program, a lot of those situations you got to be prepared to answer and spend the time with. And if you don't, you lose pieces of the program. Yeah, the unknown and the constant demand on your time is probably something I'd rank right at the top.
Well, when you took over at Iowa State, was it kind of hard for you to walk that fine line where you want to have your fingerprints all over the program, but you also have to delegate some things so that you don't get too busy doing everything?
Yeah, and my choice in delegation was the control of the offense and defense. I always felt I coordinated best with the least amount of weight over my shoulder, and I worked for some good men in Walt Harris and Dave Wanstedt and Tommy Tuberville, and when they let me go, I felt I coached my best. And so when I hired Wally Burnham as the defensive coordinator, I wanted to make sure he knew it was his defense. I was not going to put it together. I was not going to call the game. Now, there's a couple secondary coaches probably wished I would have stayed out of their business a little bit too at the same time, but I had to get my fingers dirty a little bit and coach Kneebend when it came to those guys. And then Tom had the offense and even the special teams, the guys, Shane Burnham primarily, those guys coached it, but Courtney Messingham and Todd Sturdy and Tommy Mangino, they coached the units. I sat in all those meetings, but that's where I chose to delegate the discipline and the decision making as far as travel plans and all that. I was very much involved with.
You mentioned Wally Burnham, and I know he was down there with your staff at Arkansas as well. Where did he end up? Is he still coaching anywhere?
He's retired in the state of Georgia. I just talked to him on the ride back from California, as a matter of fact. He's living on a lake in outside of Gainesville, Georgia. And the local high school coach got word that a retired Wally Burnham was in town. And he's already enlisted him to help with their program. So he's advising the defensive staff a little bit, and it's a young coordinator, I believe, who's got a great playing resume, but his coaching resume is not quite as big yet. So Wally's helping him, and then he'll spend the fall weekends watching his son Shane Burnham coach at UCF Central Florida and help that high school program out throughout the week.
All right. Well, I wanted to ask you about a couple of your former players at Iowa State who are former ranking stars as well. Of course, Joel Lanning had a great season last year after making, you know, that incredibly unlikely move from quarterback to linebacker. How surprised were you by the success that he had?
Not at all. We recruited Joel knowing that if he didn't pan out as a quarterback at that level, that he could be a linebacker. We didn't have any doubt about that. Then we saw him throw at a 7-on-7 tournament on our campus prior to his senior year in high school, and it was a really windy day. And a lot of the teams got together and chose which way they wanted to play with the wind or against it. And I remember a game in particular that Ankeny decided to go into the wind because the wind had no effect on Joel's balls. The other quarterback, you know, couldn't launch the velocity in a ball to counter the wind, and Joel's balls would just sail through it. And watching his mechanics and his ability to throw, that after that day, we knew there was no doubt that he had the physical skills to play quarterback. And when we turned the reins over to him in that 2015 season, we certainly thought he demonstrated that. And I think Todd Sturdy did a really tremendous job of coaching Joel. And had that marriage remained in effect, I think Joel would have stayed as a quarterback his entire time and been very effective as a quarterback there at Iowa State. But when it didn't work out, and I'm not saying that should have been that way, when it didn't and philosophy changed, and when it didn't, him making that move and doing it very selflessly, there was no surprise of his success there either.
Well, he certainly proved when you were there that, yeah, he could be a Big 12 caliber quarterback. So, I mean, there would be no reason to have a discussion about moving him, right?
Yeah, you wouldn't think. Because he could do it both with his legs and with his arm and put in the right situation to run the right style of offense. He would have flourished.
Well, the other guy I wanted to ask you about is Cole Netton. Of course, kickers are a little bit of a different breed. I understand that there's an April Fool's Day prank involving Cole and his mother and you. What happened there?
She will never forgive me for that. I don't believe. Never forgive. Yeah. Cole wanted to, how should we say it, just prank his mom in that he had failed a drug test. And so I called her up and did my best to be serious and concerned about the direction that Cole was going. And she was crushed. I knew I'd done a good job because she was crushed on the other end of the phone. And as a parent, I knew the anguish that she was going through there briefly. So I was very relieved when I could tell her that it was an April Fool's Day joke. But yeah, she's never forgiven me, I don't think, for that.
Yeah, that sounds like something that Cole would do.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Well, when you were growing up in Ankeny, one thing I want to ask you about, I know your brother was a big Minnesota Vikings fan. He still is to this day. Did you have a favorite NFL team when you were growing up?
Minnesota Vikings. That was the one sports team at the professional level that we were 100% together on. Yeah, fun times and fun teams to support back then, and watching them play and every Sunday you could find the both of us in front of the TV cheering them on and actually helping them at times as best we could in the living room to try to block kicks or whatever it was we needed to do. We actually would. We'd lay the beanbag chairs out and try to time it and block the kick with them. And as you remember, the Vikings were very good at blocking kicks. And there was a lot of fun when that happened as we were contributing our share in the basement.
Well, of course, when you were out at Pittsburgh, you guys shared a practice facility with the Steelers those several years that you were out there. Were you able to learn anything from watching, the Steelers staff in place and what they were doing? Anything about the NFL game? And do you ever have any thoughts about wanting to coach in the NFL?
Yeah, I have, not strongly. At the times that I have, I thought it would hurt my opportunity to become a head football coach, and I think the timing still is hard if you're in that league. To get a head coaching job at the college level. So maybe if it ever gets out of my system of wanting to be a head coach again at this level, I might try it. But we were very fortunate to have a great relationship with the Steelers. And Mr. Tim Lewis, who's now the head coach with the Birmingham team, in that new, I don't even know what that Alliance League or whatever it's called, he was the coordinator when I first got to Pitt. He was also a Pitt guy. He played at Pitt, and he was great about communicating and being able to bounce things off him and ask questions. And I was struggling with a couple things at the early part of my tenure at Pitt. One of them was what's referred to as bail coverage, where a defensive back, in particular a corner, presses the offensive receiver on the line of scrimmage like he's playing man coverage, press man coverage, and then at the very end he turns and opens up and bails out and either runs to a deep zone or he still may be playing man. He's just bailing out of there. And I was having some trouble with that particular technique, and he gave me a pointer with what he taught his guys anatomically, and I still utilize it successfully to this day. Then we were playing off coverage, and we were getting beat on some short stuff, and I was having trouble with the yardage. I was playing them off, and he actually had me back them off more to play it, and in doing so, we gave up less. And at the time, when he was trying to convince me, I struggled with, but one of the things our players were having issue with is they were scared they were going to get run by in the quick game. So they'd open up early, and by backing them off, they lost that fear that the guy was going to get past them. So they sat down more aggressively, and we played the quick game more aggressively. So those were things I picked up early from a gentleman by the name of Tim Lewis, who was the D coordinator, and then Dick LeBeau, who uber successful NFL player and coach. He took over at one point for the Steelers, and he and I also had a tremendous relationship. And he would, in season, walk over into our side of the building and answer questions for me. He would walk out onto the practice field, ask for a script so he could follow practice and what we were doing and give me advice as well. So, yeah, very fortunate to be around two tremendous football coaches like that as well as the rest of the Steelers organization.
Well, from what you saw, did the NFL coaches work any less hours than you guys did?
They actually do. I think the NFL calendar is quite a bit different. We actually, as a program at UCLA, have quite a few vacation days, and that comes from Chip being in the NFL here recently and knowing how much time they get off to charge up their batteries and so forth before the season gets started. But one piece of it is when you have your players for most of the day and aren't restricted to an NCAA four-hour limit, you get more done during the day and you're out of there a little bit earlier. Now, when I say that, if you'd look at the percentage of NFL teams, you'd say most of them are getting out of there earlier than college. Now, there's still those grinders that are there burning the after midnight oil, but with most, that's not the case. Later in the week, those guys are out of the office. I say later, like on Fridays, So their Thursday practice to us, we'd leave after practice at 6-7 o'clock. They're leaving there at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and they're done until they get back together, you know, Saturday afternoon for a walkthrough or whatever it is. So yeah, it's, and they don't have recruiting to deal with. So yeah, they leave a little bit earlier, and their off season is structured quite a bit different.
We're visiting with Paul Rhodes. This is the Ankeny Fanatic Weekly Podcast. And Paul, now I wanted to talk with you a little bit about, you know, the current climate in our society with the intersection of sports and politics. You know, there have been a lot of NFL players as well as some other well-known sports figures like LeBron James, Greg Popovich, who have been critical of the country's, you know, current administration. Do you like seeing people in those positions, you know, express their own personal political opinions?
Well, I think they're in a position where they're afforded an audience, and regardless, people are going to listen to them. And it, sometimes it's not even as much about their opinion as the fact that they're speaking, whether they have a side that people go along with or not. And I think so much of it is publicized today, where years back you didn't hear about it or potentially read about it. So I don't think they're right or wrong. That they have a stage and they utilize it, and if they feel strong about their opinions, you know, more power to them.
Well, where do you stand on the national anthem issue? Do you understand, you know, what the players are trying to accomplish?
I do and I don't. Yeah, I do and I don't. I think there are other ways, certainly, that they could get their strong opinions across in this matter. When you look at the history of our country and the importance of the national anthem and what it means to so many people in a grave sort of way. I just wish there were different angles that we could go and stay away from that particular model. At Iowa State, never had any issue with that, because the only game we were out for the national anthem was in Iowa City. And so that would have been the one game every other year that I would have had to address that, and I certainly would have beforehand, and not wanted to be surprised.
One other issue that's come up is, you know, with these teams, whether or not they're going to go to the White House when they win the championship, like the Golden State Warriors talked about that. So it's like, when you guys win the national championship this year, you know, are you going to be in favor of going to the White House?
I'll be one of the first ones on that plane. what an honor. Whether you believe in everything that the president stands for or not, what a tremendous honor. You know, Barack Obama mentioned my name in a speech when he came to Iowa State's campus, and I just thought that was the neatest thing ever, to have your name come out of the mouth of the president of the United States. And I didn't vote for him. So, I still thought it was just the coolest thing ever. And when he arrived, I was on the east side of Jack Trice Stadium watching the helicopters land. I mean, it's the president of the United States, and to have that opportunity, I promise you, I wouldn't turn it down.
Yeah, that would have been a cool moment for you. Well, to finish up with you, Paul, here, I want to take you back to your Ankeny days a little bit. Of course, when you grew up there in Ankeny, you played for some legendary coaches like Jerry Pezzetti, Larry Ireland. What are some of your memories of playing for Coach Pezzetti?
You know, my dad at the time was the head football coach at Des Moines Lincoln. And if I couldn't play for my father, I couldn't think of another man that I would have rather played for. And he and I shared a moment after we lost to Roosevelt in the playoffs in 1984, and I told him as much. He cared so much about his players. He has his way of motivation that takes place just year round. It's subtle phrases or conversations, and I cherished memories of playing for Coach Pezzetti.
Well, of course, he's still going strong. So who do you think is going to retire first, you or Coach Pezzetti?
you know what? I think you could have an over-under on that, because I think there is some likelihood that he could be around longer than me as far as coaching this profession.
Well, I think he's gearing up for his 58th season of high school football, which is just truly amazing. Have you given any thought, really, though, to how much longer you want to coach? You know, is Vicky tired of moving yet?
She's not tired of moving. We've actually sort of embraced that in this profession. Because if you don't, first it'll drive you crazy. But we've got to see so many different parts of the country and experience so many things and meet so many people. It's been a tremendous ride as far as that goes. I have told her multiple times and that I'd like to coach 40 years, and this is my 30th season at the Division I football level. So we'll see if I got 11 more in me or not. After the Iowa State tenure, I started to think more and more about, you know, how much more I really wanted to grind it out. But the passion is very much still there, and I credit getting back into the classroom with my own position group and experiencing that thrill again and not the thrill of operating a fire hose like you have to often as a head coach.
Are there some things that you're looking forward to doing, you know, when you retire, but besides riding your Harley and coming to places, you know, like Clear Lake?
Traveling, yeah, absolutely traveling. So much of the country that we want to see. We just drove here, leaving Los Angeles Sunday night, and drove to Vegas, and then drove from Vegas to Denver. So 15 to 76 and 76 into Denver. And if you have never made that drive, now that's one to put on your list, because I mean, just gorgeous country. But we want to do a lot of that, and part of it she likes, part of it she doesn't like. Like one of the things is buying a toy hauler or a pickup truck camper and pulling the Harley around and just taking off and going for a while and stopping and riding and camping and all that. She's not real keen on that idea yet, but travel and motorcycle riding's at the top of the list.
All right. Well, the last thing I had for you, I wanted to take you back to the summer of 1977. You might know where I'm going with this, but as a 10-year-old, you played on a juggernaut of a little league team there in Ankeny. Do you remember much about that team?
It was a great team. There was great chemistry on that team, and a lot of good guys and names and faces that I can still recognize today. When I was coming through Ankeny Tuesday night, I looked over towards Old Kiwanis Park and actually thought about that experience in Diamond 2 and the short porch there on in right field because of Four Mile Creek and so forth. But yeah, it was a pleasure playing with you back then, I promise you.
Well, likewise. I was trying to find an old photo of that team, and I couldn't find it. And I remember, of course, we had Coach Schneider. His son Dave was one of our primary pitchers. But since I couldn't find that photo, I was just trying to rack my brain, trying to figure out, you know, who else played on that team. Do you remember any of the names on that team?
Triangan was on that team. Rusty Walker was on that team as well. Swanson Boy was on that team. I can't remember what his first name was.
Eric Steinick was on that team, wasn't he?
I think that's correct. Yep, I think that's correct. We were a gritty group, I think we could best be described as.
What I remember about that team is I think we probably finished last in the regular season, but we went on a run in the postseason. I think we got to the championship game, and then we ran out of pitchers.
Yeah, which was easy to happen. Those Orioles uniforms were great uniforms, too.
They were. Well, you're listening to the Ankeny Fanatic Weekly Podcast. This has been Paul Rhodes talking with us, and we really appreciate the time, Paul. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.